to the third session about C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And if you're here for the third time, congratulations, you survived. If you're here for the first time, welcome, glad to have you. I always tell my students that I, as an ELCA pastor and as a college professor, have the dual power of putting you to sleep with twice the ability of anybody else. it's really, if you made it for the third time, I'm impressed. I appreciate your being here. Maybe you just like good naps, I'm not sure. So these three sessions, we looked first of all at J.R.R. Tolkien's life, we looked at C.S. Lewis' life, and this lecture stands alone. What I want to do from those two lectures is kind of pull some things together and think about this question, are C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien some of the early ecologists that in the early 20th century, they're both born in the 19th century, were they some of the earliest people who started having the idea that we need to take care of nature and land and things like that in kind of a modern sense of what we think of ecologists? There's kind of a debate about that. I would like to read a quote by Shelley Seguro and Deborah Tucker. They wrote an article called Tolkien and Trees. And the opening line of that article reads like this: our sense of the forest derives as much from the depictions we encounter in stories or read in childhood as from our actual experiences and expectations of forests as we walk through them. The expectations of enchantment or the sense of threat within fictional forests animates how we actually understand real forests. I think I'm a product of that quote in a real way. I grew up in Odessa, Washington, not too far from here. In late sixth grade, towards the end of that year, a local farmer, his name was Marvin Fink, a typical sort of farmer in this area, a very gruff, kind of big, hard person with big, massive hands with lots of calluses and a heart of gold hidden inside that sort of gruff body. And Marvin asked me to come out and move irrigation pipes on his farm, and which I started doing. If you were here at the Tolkien lecture, you heard that I was struggled in school for a long time. My parents eventually gave me a tutor, and it was about that time that I was now going out into the wheat fields. Imagine my parents let me do this. I would go and work in the morning before school. So it was like 4 o'clock, I'd go out and we'd move irrigation pipes and then I'd get back. And my wife always complained to Marvin that he paid me money to do this, but my parents lost money because I ate like 12 eggs and a stack of pancakes and things, and they couldn't afford my eating at that point because I was working so hard before school, and then I'd go out after school and work on the farm. And my experiences on the farm were magical in some ways. I remember one morning, it was very, very misty. I'm moving a 75-foot irrigation pipe that's 3 inches around, and I'm picking this thing up, and I'm walking through the fog, and then I hook it up, and I set it down, and I go and get another one. And as I was walking halfway through one morning, I came about to you and me away. I was walking along, and there was a coyote just sitting there. And I'm sitting with this pipe, and I'm like, if he bites it, I'm like, what am I going to do, drop it on him? I had no idea what to do. And we just stood and stared at each other. And he was very casual, looking at me. And what seemed like an hour, right? I'm sure it was seconds, maybe a minute, but it seemed like an eternity. And I just kind of got up and walked away. And there were always these sorts of magical moments. Like the one time I was moving pipes through the spring wheat was really, really high. So I really couldn't see anything. Very, very difficult, so bad that I had to walk to the end and hook up the pipe by hand because I couldn't see it. And I remember I was walking through and I stepped on something that moved and I fell down and I got up and I was towards the edge of a road and pulled out and it was a badger. I thought, I could have lost my leg. Everybody could have eaten me. There was two kind of encounters: magical mystery and wonder and absolute fear. And those two types of things are kind of the encounters that we have with nature in experience. But it was at the same time that a teacher that I was fortunate to have gave me The Hobbit, and I started experiencing the woods and forests and nature through books. And I think those two things coming together were really important. And I'm not sure about how you experienced them, but I think it was true. And Narnia was one of those books that came along around that time. First of all, Lord of the Rings, and then Narnia later after I was done with him. So when I think about trees and how trees are important and how trees and stories about trees shape us, right? Trees have been important because both in Tolkien's and Lewis's works, they're important because they shape our attitudes towards nature and how we think of what trees do for us and give us. Somebody walked in and said, I was kind of flipping around looking at this and go, oh, I love that book, right? And I think this is probably one of the first books that I gave to my kids, right? And reading about what trees do and the sorts of sacrifices of trees. And I remember my kids being really sad when the trees cut down, right? And he wants to be a boat for them. And we teach, but these stories about nature teach us about truth. They teach us about wonder. Then they teach us about how to interpret the experiences that we have. And there is a sense in which when we read these books, they give us an enchantment. They cast a spell on us. And that spell is to see all woods with wonder after that. I remember going to a conference one time and a person got up and said, you know, I was going to give a paper on this topic, but then I read this book, and it had already been written, and it was too late for me to do anything new, so I'm just going to talk about these books. In a way, I had this idea for these lectures about Tolkien and Lewis, and then I later on came on these books by Matthew Dickerson, who edited both of them, although he has different co-authors. They're really, really good books. Ants, Elves, and Eriador, The Environmental Vision of J.R. Tolkien, and Narnia and the Fields of Arbol, in the environment vision of C.S. Lewis. I recommend them to you. I'm borrowing a lot from them, but I'm also changing some of the ideas or nuancing some of them along the way because I think that's what I can bring to it. I myself am a medievalist trained at Notre Dame, and I got into medieval studies because of Tolkien, because of Lewis, and I wanted to read what they were reading and how they came out to be the people that they were. And I find it interesting that when we look at Tolkien and Lewis, often they are, even in their own private lives, this is some of the last pictures of Tolkien in his life. I'm just a picture of Jack Lewis, the name that he liked to go by instead of Clive, out walking. And one of the things that we see in their experience is that nature, says Lewis, the only imperative that nature utters is look, listen, and attend. And one of the problems in our modern society is that we never stop. And we never start looking and see the world around us or even understand what's going on. And there is a few ideas in Lewis and Tolkien, I think, where they suggest that the reality of the way we see nature, we shouldn't see it as it is, but we should see it as it should be. And in order to explain that idea, I want to use a quote from Man of La Mancha, the end of Man of La Mancha, where Cervantes, who is talking about Don Quixote, he's in prison, Cervantes is in prison, and he tells the story of Don Quixote. And somebody says to him, well, Don Quixote was insane. He tilted with windmills. He thought prostitutes were his lover, and Sancho was a great knight. And this is the response of Cervantes to the man who asked the questions. I myself have been a soldier and a slave. I have seen my comrades fall in battle or die more slowly under the lash in Africa. I have held them in my arms at their final moments. These were men who saw life as it is. They died despairing. No glory, no brave last words, only in their eyes, filled with confusion, the question why. I do not think they were wondering why they were dying, but rather why they had ever lived. When life itself seems lunatic, who knows where madness lies? To surrender dreams, this may be madness. to seek treasure where there is only trash. Too much sanity may be madness, but maddest of all is to see life as it is and not as it should be. One of the things that we see is that fairy stories for Tolkien and for Lewis were the stories that shaped their understanding of the world and nature. They were both very much interested in Arthur Rackham's illustrations, and notice how beautiful these sorts of illustrations are. Two different types of illustrations, the story of Red Riding Hood and the wolf, and just a normal tree, which is very enchanted, right? And then a tree that is like a dryad in Grimm's fairy tales. And they both loved these stories, but they knew that they were formed by them, and they knew that these stories had created wonder in them at an early age, so that they could never walk through the forest like Peggy and my wife and I did yesterday when we were on our way to Long Lake, Olden Lake, I should say, last night, and we saw this tree as we were walking, and I couldn't help but think that there was this face in the tree, and I was thinking about Tolkien and Lewis, and I was worried about bears, I was thinking about a deer, the deer that was standing in the road that wouldn't let us by as we were trying to come back, and there is a sense of wonder and imagination just in any forest that you have because of what fairy stories do to us. It's almost as if we are looking through the world, and Tolkien and Lewis both had this idea that, and they have quotes like this, it's as if we are living in a dream and we are trying to wake ourselves up. G.K. Chesterton has this quote in The Everlasting Man, written in 1925. He says, "There comes a time in the afternoon of our lives where little boys stop playing cops and robbers, and it is then that they torment the cat. There comes a time in the afternoon of our lives when we are bored, and it is as if we are in our dreams and we are trying to wake ourselves up with our nightmares." I teach a religion and film class at Concordia, and when we talk about horror films, I said, why is there such a fascination with horror films with young people? And the conclusion we usually come to is that a lot of times life is boring and something horrible, and feeling shock and horror is better than feeling nothing at all. And that's one of the things that we want to wake ourselves up to. Well, even in The Wizard of Oz, trees can be kind of scary. Remember the apple tree when Dorothy tries to pick the apple and the tree slaps her hand and they start getting mad at her. Lewis and Tolkien both suggest that we are trying to wake ourselves up from the dream that the world is teaching us. And that dream is a lie. And that lie suggests that nature is a commodity and that we want and need cheap food and that we can pollute our rivers and throw gunk into the air as long as we can have big malls and products that come from nature and the world around us cheaply, and we can buy stuff. And Lewis and them said, only fantasy, I'm quoting Paul Kocher, who is writing about Tolkien, he said, it seems to me that only fantasy can provide some recovery of knowledge of ourselves and the world around us and renew us with a sense of wonder about nature today. Or as Lewis said, we need to sneak past the dragons of our own worldviews. And we do that by writing fantasy and using imagination. Well, were Tolkien and Lewis ecologists? In a way, I could just end the lecture right now and just say no, not in the modern sense, right? Because there was no such thing as an organized movement or things like that in that time. Although you can find literature that values the beauty and wonder of nature, and they were reading those things, and they were mostly medieval texts. And Lewis said, we have a chronological snobbery. We think we're smarter than generations that came before us, just because our science and our math and our hospitals are better than they were in the past, but we forget to look to the past to see about the wonder that it teaches us about creation the love that we have can have for a divine being, and also that we can look inside our own hearts and see the wonder of how creation, creator, and creature fit together.
What was the time period you're talking about?
So Lewis dies in 1963, the same day John Kennedy dies. And Tolkien dies a little over 10 years later, in 1973. So we're talking about their writing. Tolkien published The Hobbit in 1937. Lewis started publishing The Narnia Chronicles in 1950, although he had already been writing the science fiction trilogy in the 1930s. So this whole idea, then, is one of the suggestions that they would say to us is that the problem of understanding the world is our lack of imagination. And so they start creating. Lewis says to Tolkien, we need to write the books that we want to read because nobody else is writing them. And they have these same sensitivities, although I would like to argue today, I think their sensitivities were different. And they wanted to promote especially a better understanding of the world. And they certainly knew that there were problems in the world. This is the deforestation of Sherwood Forest in the 19th century. And Lewis and Tolkien were horrified that these great medieval forests were being chopped down. I don't know if many of you know about toilet paper, but their toilet paper comes best from old, old forests, and they are chopping down entire forests in Canada for toilet paper. And Lewis and Tolkien said, we need a new understanding of how to get back to the world around us. And how do we get back in touch with that? And they thought that had to be through creation, through imagination. And one of the things that they realized was that if you're going to talk about creation and create a wonder about creation, you have to talk about the creator. And so Lewis and Tolkien, both in their mythologies, in the Lord of the Rings mythology, Tolkien really wrote this book called The Silmarillion as a background to everything he did in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings before. It wasn't published until long after that because he wasn't quite happy with it. Nobody really wanted to publish it because it's very different than The Lord of the Rings. But of course, when it was sold, and his son Christopher Tolkien, who's still alive, he's like 95 or something Christopher is still publishing these books. When Christopher brought this out, of course, it was a huge success because people were interested in the story afterwards. And they both have creation stories, and Lewis comes in the magician's nephew. There are seven of the Chronicles of Narnia, and this is the sixth of them, The Last Battle is Last. But Lewis wrote this last because he couldn't figure it out. It was the most difficult one to play with, and it's part because he was trying to figure out how do you tell the story of creation. And so they both said, we have to use our imaginations. We have to get into the idea of wonder. Einstein said once, imagination is more important than knowledge, for knowledge is limited to all we know and understand, while imagination embraces the entire world and all there ever will be to know and understand. In other words, you can move beyond knowledge with your imagination, and that can help you move to places such as place of wondering in the heart, caring and loving other people, whereas knowledge is often kind of cold and rigid. C.S. Lewis put it this way, for me, reason is the natural organ of truth, but imagination is the organ of meaning. Imagination produces new metaphors or revivifies old and is not the cause of truth, but it is its condition. Tolkien, speaking on the same topic, suggested a single dream is more powerful than 1,000 realities. And so they were very, very captivated, very, very interested in the idea of trying to understand the whole notion of creation. And when they were trying to think about how do we create, think about the creation of the world as it might have happened in this world called the Lord of the Rings or in this world Narnia, they both went back to trees. In Tolkien, this is actually Tolkien's art. He drew this, and Tolkien was quite a good artist. And his creation story in the Silmarillion, he goes back to create the trees of Valinor. One is the night tree with silver apples, and the other one is the day tree with golden apples. And there's a whole mythology he creates about this. And Tolkien and his a magician's nephew has the main character Diggory go to a tree, also with a silver apple that he has to bring back to Aslan. And in this one, in these creation stories, they are trying to offer a sense of wonder and mystery, and it's so interesting that both of them do the same thing. Now, they were reading each other's works. They were being critical of each other's works and helping each other along the way. They were very good friends, very dear friends. And one of the things that they both concluded was that the creation of the universe must be done by singing. It had to be a word. Now, the Bible suggests in Genesis 1 that God creates with the word. And Lewis and Tolkien say, and that word must have been sung. And that means that there was harmony created in the universe. And that harmony is best seen in trees and in giant gardens. And when a garden is cultivated and properly nourished, it's such a beautiful thing. For me, being back here, just eating the apricots is such a beautiful thing. I remember the Washington apricots from having grown up here, and it just reminds me of my youth, but also something beyond it as well. And so they use these stories, and therefore evil, in a minute you will see, naturally therefore had to be something about disharmony. Evil upsets the harmony of the created universe, and then things go awry. One of the things I will say is Lewis loved Tolkien's work so much that he kept urging Tolkien to publish. Tolkien probably never would have published had it not, The Lord of the Rings, had it not been for C.S. Lewis. He says that in his own letters. Tolkien didn't like Narnia. A couple of reasons was he kind of thought, Jack, did you steal that idea from me about creation? You've read my book, and there's another story that he seems to have stolen. Jack would always go, no, it's just, at least Lewis didn't think he had stolen it. It was just kind of in his subconscious, and he sometimes borrowed things from The Lord of the Rings at the same, but they both came out about the same time, so in the same time frame, so it was hard to know who wrote what first. Maybe Tolkien borrowed from him. But in any case, the idea is that you have to start with creation, and you have to start with a creator. And in Narnia, it was Aslan who sings Narnia into being. And in Tolkien's, it was, you go back to the Silmarillion, and it goes back to the creator creating the world there. Now, one of the things that they both argue at this time, Iluvatar, the great creator here in creating the universe, is what sort of life does this creator create? And in both cases, in their stories, here's a few illustrations coming from The Hobbit, and the opening of The Hobbit story is where the hobbits are together and they're having a big party and they're eating together. And you see that it's kind of like a very small sort of community. It's a very agricultural community, and it's very much like a small town, like the town I grew up in. Everybody knew everybody's business. So, certain people had certain characteristics that people made fun of. And but notice it's usually a party where everybody gets together. I will notice, if you've read The Hobbit, you'll know that the opening story of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings is both a birthday party. But notice that hobbits do not live the way humans do. Because we humans, when we have a birthday party, grandson's birthday party was a few days ago, we were there and people brought him presents. In Hobbiton, you gave away things. Because things you don't need, and things that other people can need. And so you give away and you seek the simple life. Do just the opposite of what we do in our world. And that's something that's important. In Narnia, for example, the simple life is illustrated in The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe when they go to the house of the beavers, and the beavers take them in, the kids who have just wandered into Narnia and don't know what's going on. And as they're sitting at this table, one of the beavers says, well, you know about Aslan. They go, no, who's Aslan? And they say, Aslan? And then the next line, Lewis says, it was as if their hearts were open to joy. Just in hearing the name, although they did not know who it was. just interesting, beautiful lines. But it comes out of this sort of harmony, simple life, sharing, being hospitable, being kind, and loving to one another. Simplicity. E.F. Schumacher, in his 1973 book called Small is Beautiful, makes this observation. He says, the pressure and strain of living is very much less in places like Burma than it is in the United States, in spite of the fact that the United States has a great amount of labor-saving machinery used in the former country in only a minute fraction of the amount used in the latter. We do not save time with labor-saving machinery, we lose it. And suggesting that small is beautiful, Richard Foster, in his Celebration as a Discipline, talks about greed, and he says this, the lust for what we do not need is psychotic. We have a psychosis in our world. We lose touch with reality. Greed is an industry and self-destructive, and our entire culture is built upon it. The simple life will save us. C.S. Lewis, once writing to J.R.R. Tolkien, writes this, the feeling about home must have been quite different in the days when families fed on produce that just came from a few miles away in the country. And those farms were there for 6 and 7 generations with the people that lived there, and they cared for the land. Perhaps this was why they could see nymphs and dryads in their forests. And they were not mistaken if they thought they had run across a fairy, because they were so connected to the countryside, it was as if when the earth and the air and the corn came together and they kneaded it into bread and ate it, they ate the earth, the air, and the corn together and lived in wonder. Interesting. This whole notion that the simple life is something that we want to simply be a part of. At the end of The Hobbit, there's a dwarf. His name is Thorin. He's the king of the dwarves, and he's dying. And Bilbo the Hobbit, who is living in this scene, the guy sitting on the chair, is standing next to him. And the dwarf, Thorin, if you know the plot of The Hobbit, he and his dwarves went to the Lonely Mountain to try to recover the dragon gold, which the dragon had stolen from the dwarves. And also then the dragon had even a greater hoard of gold that he had. And they want to go back and recover it. And it's a complicated story, but at the end, Thorin is wounded and he's dying. And Bilbo comes to him. And Thorin says to him, "Ah, my dear Hobbit, if more of us valued food and shelter like you hobbits, above hoarding gold as I had gotten caught up with, it would be a much merrier world." And again, Tolkien and Lewis here is suggesting that the dragon disease, the dragon sickness that's within society is the hoarding instinct of society. And contrasting this to The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien notes that the orcs, the servants of Saruman, the evil lord there, the orcs were working. Tolkien says in one place, they were incapable of making anything beautiful. They made machines that served their master and saved them labor and chopped down the trees, but it made them slothful. Wow. Hobbits love to create beauty. They do it in their gardens, they do it in their furniture, and they do it through their simple lives. Sam Gamgee, one of the characters in The Lord of the Rings, is a simple gardener, and he loves trees. And the whole story ends with Sam. He's in his house, and he sits down. He says, "I'm home." It's the last word in The Lord of the Rings. I'm back. I'm home. This is what we want. This is what we need. And yet we seek after machinery and time-saving devices. Well, what about the nature of evil? So if the simple life is goodness, and it comes through appreciation of nature and creation, we have a couple of interesting characters in The Lord of the Rings and in Narnia. In Lord of the Rings, we have this character named Gollum. And Gollum is an interesting character because we don't know much about him. In The Hobbit, what we find is Bilbo is going through the mines of Moria, and he finds this ring, and he finds that this goblin, Gollum, has lost, or we think he's a goblin. And then later on in The Lord of the Rings, we find out that he was actually a hobbit. But he had been putting on this ring, which made him invisible. And the more he put it on, the more he became obsessed by the ring. And Gandalf says, it was like he was a small piece of butter spread out of too big a piece of bread. Now, the other idea of evil we'll get to in a minute, the White Witch Jadis and the language in the wardrobe. Both Lewis and Tolkien were very fond of St. Augustine, a 5th century theologian. And Augustine is a very important theologian. He helps establish many theological concepts and ideas. Luther was an Augustinian hermit. He was a part of the order of the Augustinians, and so he and loved Augustine's ideas, especially Augustine's ideas on grace and evil. Now, his idea of evil is something we don't talk about much. And I'll just use a simple illustration to try to get across the point of what Tolkien and Lewis think about what evil really is. The idea that Augustine suggested was that all things are created good. If all things are created good, and the creation and creatures in the world are created good, then what is evil? So humans have the ability to be sub-creators. This is one of the great gifts that God gives humans. They can't create anything out of nothing. We can create things in our imagination, or we can create things out of the soil or out of the metals that we find, but God can create out of nothing. That's why God is God. But the greatest gift God gives us is to be sub-creators. And one of the things that we can sub-create are things that are useful, tools. For example, we can create a bucket. And the function of a bucket is to hold water, carry sand, and that's its purpose. We create things with purpose. Art's purpose is to teach us to be in tune with the other. Something that we don't know. For example, the art of writing can put us into a different world so that we can see our world more clearly. Or a painting can help us have an emotion or a feeling and give us a sense of wonder about something else. So we have this bucket, says Augustine. And what would be evil in a bucket? A hole. Right? That's what evil would be. You put a bucket in it, it no longer can fulfill its purpose. Evil always keeps something from fulfilling its purpose. Now, says Augustine, what is the substance of that evil? It's a lack of something. It's a lack of wholeness. Evil can only exist in relation to good. It can't fully exist. If the bucket were completely evil, it wouldn't exist. Even Dante, in his Dante's Inferno, understands this. The devil is at the center of the earth, and the devil's legs are in a lake, and Satan is got these wings, and he's evil, and he's prideful, and he wants to take over God's place in the world, and so he beats his wings harder and harder to be released from the center of the Inferno, and the harder he beats, the harder the ice gets in his legs, and he can't get out. Now, if he were humble, he could get away. But he isn't, so he's always going to be stuck there. The other thing is the question is, well, was the devil good? And Augustine said, yes, right? The devil was a heavenly creature. He was an angel who rebelled against God. He stopped fulfilling his purpose. His purpose was to praise God, to follow God, to go after God. And when he did that, there was a lack, and his purpose had fallen apart. There's a lack in the world. And so, humans, what is the function of humans? What is the purpose of humans? Tolkien, Augustine, Lewis, all would argue, the Augustine of humans, the purpose of humans is to love God and to be stewards to creation and to be hospitable to God's world and other creatures. But when we stop doing that, then that lack of our following our purpose means that we become maybe seduced by somebody like Jadis. In a way, that image that I just told you from Dante fits both of these images. The devil can't fulfill his purpose because he's, well, we find out later that this guy was a hobbit, and he becomes less and less a hobbit, and more animal-like, more and more goblin-like, because he's seduced by evil. He can't fulfill his purpose, which is to care for others in the creation. Now, Jadis is the other side of that evil. The devil, the name for the devil that we sometimes give him is Lucifer, right? If you go to the Latin, that's from two words, lux facio. Lux meaning light, facio means to make. Lucifer is the light maker. He's the one who pretends to be the one who cares about creation, or the one who pretends to be the most powerful one. But really, all the witch is about is her own power, her own preservation, her own wealth, her own world. But she seduces by being not fulfilling her purpose, but she looks like she's fulfilling her purpose. Both Lewis and Tolkien suggest that what we need to do with evil is we need to keep our eyes open. We need to be aware of them. And so the purpose of God was then to bring Christ into the world, because the world has fallen and there are people and like us, and the creation itself is broken and the world is broken and the things we make are broken. And now we need somebody to show us the way back to our purpose. And the incarnation is that. Christ comes, he is God, becomes human, and somehow sanctifies the entire cosmos again. Not just people, creation itself, the world. And when God does that, we need to see the beauty in each other. I take students to Greece regularly. And one of the things that I love about Greek Orthodox Christianity is they have icons, right? And the priest brings out the censer, and he senses the saints in the icon and offers prayers, like offering prayers to the saint to help them. And then at one point in the worship service, he turns and he senses the people. And the reason he does is because he wants to remind the people that they're in the image of God. And we can see God in each other. And if we don't see God in each other, we've got problems. And this is difficult in a society where we're so divided, right? Well, in any case, an author that both of them liked very much was a guy by the name of George MacDonald. He wrote a book called Fantasties, which when Lewis read it, he said baptized his imagination. MacDonald has this really interesting observation, which both of them were very enamored of. And he said, when talking about creation and creatures, he said, to will God's will means to see in a tree the entire glory of God. He could say the same thing about other people. To invest in a tree means to profit spiritually from such love, to care about the creation and the world around us. The cold scientist, he said, or the lumberjack, sees only profit in trees. Right? What the tree will give him, not what we can bring back or what the tree can give us, which is a sense of wonder in the universe. For those who can see clearly, God is found in trees and creation. Well, so Tolkien and Lewis on creation, and I want to just sum up a few things that I've talked about. One thing that I haven't visited too much about is the idea of beauty. Beauty is that thing, it's God in creation seducing us like a lover, wooing us into a relationship, a compassionate, loving relationship. The wonder of the incarnation, it gives us a sacramental worldview. It's interesting, Lewis wrote his book, Mere Christianity, some radio broadcasts from in the 1940s, and in there he says, I'm just going to talk about things that are mere Christianity, things that are common to everybody. But he talks about sacramentality, which a lot of Protestants, Baptists, Pentecostals, and others would not hold to. They don't hold to a sacramental worldview. And when Lewis was kind of asked, you know, you should really take that out, Lewis goes, how can you not have sacramentality? It was beyond him. He just thought it was so central to the Christian message. So he does kind of keep that idea in there, although others question him. But for him, if he didn't have that, you couldn't move to kind of this idea of the sacredness or the beauty of nature. And that what we do with nature, and as we understand nature, is it gives joy to us because it makes us realize what's important. It makes us realize what our purpose is to love God, to love neighbor, and to love all of creation. And when we live out of that love, we live in what Lewis called a well-ordered society, a society that is not just about its own goodness or seeking its own benefit, but is about the goodness of all of creation. And both of them use the imagery of heaven being green. That if you want to talk about heaven and it has a color, it's green. Well, I'm going to suggest, along with Dickerson and the authors before, that overall, if there's a principle that Tolkien has, and this was the last picture we have from Tolkien's life, he died not too long after that. This is a tree that he really loved. It was in a botanical gardens next to him where his house was, and he often went and sat with the tree just to be with it, to be in its presence. One of the things he argued, I think he's arguing in Lord of the Rings, is that stewardship is how our responsibility should be towards nature. That we are custodial, and we have selfless custodial care with the nature that we have around us. I find it really interesting. There's a great story about Tolkien. There was a lady across the street, and she was trimming her trees, and Tolkien goes out over there, and he says, "What are you doing?" She says, "Well, the trees are causing shade, and I can't get any more light in my windows." And he says, "You're torturing it. You're abusing the tree. Let the tree be a tree. It's wild. Let it be." And then he had this. There was a story about he was walking along the road one time, and they were building a road, and he was standing there, and somebody heard him yell, "That's the last arable land in England. There it goes." And he was just. Some people just thought he was a little bit nuts, right? You know, that. Oh, well, this is progress. How can you be against progress? Have you ever heard that? My son made a documentary about the Williston oil fields, and we were talking with both oil people and farmers, and that was the exact same words one of the oil workers said to us. How can you be against progress? Did you drive here? You need oil. You can't be against progress. In The Lord of the Rings, this idea of stewardship comes through even in the names of some of the characters. For example, Denethor is the steward of Gondor, and Gandalf comes to him, and he reminds him, he says, "My lord steward, it is your task to keep this kingdom. I shall not fail wholly in my task, though Gondorshorp should perish, for I too am a steward." Notice Gandalf and the other characters of leaderships are qualified by being stewards. If anything passes through this night that can still grow fair or bear fruit and flower again in the days to come, I am its steward, as are you, Lord Denethor. So whenever Gandalf calls a leader to do something, he doesn't just call them to be good to the people, he calls them to be good to the land. Wendell Berry said once, I do not have much faith in long-term stewardship or broad stewardship, but I have great faith in private stewardship. In other words, what he means is that we must all embrace our own stewardship of the earth where we are as individuals, and then do what ability we have with leadership to help others do that. Frodo says to Gandalf, one of the characters in The Lord of the Rings, he says, "The ring has come to him." He's got the eagle ring. It's his choice. "Why does this ring come to me?" And Gandalf, later on, he doesn't say anything to him, but he says later, "I don't know why." So Frodo tries to give Gandalf the ring. He's the great wizard, right? And Gandalf said, "No, don't tempt me. Because if I had it, it would be too much to bear. Hobbits, on the other hand, can bear the ring, little creatures, because their ambition is small." They have no ambition. They want simply that simple life that they were created to live. And so they can resist the powers of the ring longer than others. And so Frodo says, I wish this ring had never come to me. I wish none of this would have happened. And Gandalf says, so do all who live in such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we decide to do is what we have to do with the time that's given us. That's our only task. And so we start simple, and we move out from there. The quote I had at the beginning of this class, I wanted to come back. This is Holden Lake behind a picture I took. This is Heart Lake. It is not our part, says Gandalf, to master all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us. For the succor of those years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after us may have clean earth to till. What weather they shall have is not ours to rule. Or put more simply, some believe it is only great power that can hold evil in check. But that is not what I have found. I have found that it is the small everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keep the darkness at bay, small acts of kindness and love. And I think that's what Wendell Berry was making the argument about a few moments ago. These are the things that keep things at bay, and that's why Tolkien and Lewis and their stories uplift this sort of simple life that we're talking about. Well, if Tolkien was interested in stewardship, and that comes through in his books quite clearly. One of the ideas is that Lewis' idea is about hospitality. Now, hospitality is a fabulous word. Tolkien was really into language, and I am too. My favorite dictionary is the etymological dictionary. I always want to figure out where words come from and why they work. And so, like, you have this word hospitality. We get our word hospital, we have words hospice, and it goes hospices. Hospes is a Latin word which means, interesting, you can't tell what it means because it can mean either one of two things, guest or host. The two opposites. And I think if we think of it broadly like that, we can see what Lewis is trying to get at with regard to our responsibility toward neighbor and creation and nature. So, for example, we have the beaver story, and we have also the story of Prince Caspian, these Pauline Baynes illustrations, which Lewis was very fond of. They're all in the old versions of that. So we have this idea of hospitality. And notice that when the children go to Narnia, they come from this world. They're sucked into Narnia through magical ways, through the wardrobe, they're in a train station, or a variety of ways. Once they get to Narnia, they are the guest, and they require a host to show hospitality to them first. Otherwise, they can't survive. They're in this strange land. They're in this strange world. And then later on, the children become the kings, the lords, and the ladies of this land, and then they have the responsibility to be the host to the rest of Narnia. And the role switches. And I think one of the things that we have to realize is that creation is not only something we take care of, but something that takes care of us, right? And if we think about that dual sort of relationship that I think Lewis and Tolkien are getting at, and sometimes that idea of stewardship might not get that other side, but that's where I think Lewis is helpful here, we can now begin to see what this is about. And again, the villains in both of their stories, in The Lord of the Rings and in Narnia, are always people who do not show stewardship or hospitality to other people. In The Last Battle, one of the great villains of any book is a character named Shift. He is an ape who pretends to be human. And he is so clever, he's so wise and clever, that he can always use truth in a way to bend it to his own needs. And it's like false news, right? You know, whenever he needs something, he gives a little bit of truth, and then he makes up a lie and to his advantage. And he is not, he's never a host, he's always self-absorbed. Lewis, I would say if there's an image for Tolkien, it's trees, right? He constantly comes back to trees as being the symbol of nature in the universe, and that's why we need to take care of them. For Lewis, it was animals. And Lewis was belonged to the anti-vivisectionist society. He was one of the earliest advocates for animal rights. And I would like to read, he wrote the pamphlets for the anti-vivisectionists. He says, and there's a very interesting argument right here. How can we formulate the human privilege for tormenting animals? So he's saying, we as humans have used an argument that we can torment animals, we can experiment on them, we can cut them up, so that it will not equally imply angelic privilege of tormenting people. Notice his argument. If we say that we as humans are superior to animals, we can do whatever we want with them, couldn't the angel, which is superior to us, do whatever he wanted to us or she wanted to us? And wouldn't we say, no, no, that's evil, right? You know, if an angel started playing with us and started cutting us open, we would say, no, 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 that's not a just relationship. So it's a very clever argument he makes. And then he says, and does not the superiority claim for people over animals consist partly in not tormenting them? I agree that there is room for honest difference. Now notice how this is so different than our dialogue today, right? Lewis sets out his claim. I think we shouldn't torture animals. Now I know there's room for honest dialogue, and there should be a difference of opinion on these matters, but I would lay down one stick rule. If on grounds of real, divinely ordained superiority of Christian, a Christian pathologist thinks it right to vivisect and does so with scrupulous care to avoid the least dram or scruple of unnecessary pain, in a trembling awe at the responsibility which he assumes, the restrictions he's placing on this guy, but he says, I'm willing to talk to you. And with vivid sense of high mode in which human life must be lived, it is to justify the sacrifice made for it, then, whether we agree with him or not, we can respect his point of view. Doesn't leave much room, but we're going to have a conversation, okay? Well, so we have now two really strong opinions. Lewis is working towards animal rights. Tolkien, very a strong advocate for working for trees. He would often write the people that were in charge of the city to protect trees and various areas and things. So I think I think this is a real good point to just kind of stand up. Are you hot? I know I'm waving my arms, so maybe I'm creating a wind vacuum for you all. And while we're standing, let me stop for a minute. Do you have any questions about any of this? Yeah.
Was Lewis a vegetarian?
Was Lewis a vegetarian? No, he wasn't. But he did believe that it was important for animals to have be slaughtered in a proper way. And so, you know, that's the whole notion of kosher. But he wasn't strictly vegetarian. Although he did have he moved to a house called the Kilns. It's in Oxford. You can still go see it. And it had a fair amount of property and land about it. And he had chickens and dogs. And he had a gardener. And by the way, the gardener was a grumpy old coot. And if you've read The Silver Chair, the character of Puddleglum is based on him. And so that was his gardener. And so he had this great deal of respect for animals. And there's a story about, I told this the other day, that Lewis had an office at Magdalen College in Oxford. And every night he knew it was ready to go home is when the mice would start coming out. And he never set a trap. He never worried. He said, the mice are coming out. I said, okay, it's your turn. Your office is yours now. You can get whatever crumbs I've left behind. So even, I don't know how much he ate, how much meat he ate, I'm not sure about that. But yeah.
What is vivisection? I'm sorry.
Vivisection means to cut open animals for experiments. Especially he was really upset about the use, experimenting animals for cosmetics for women.
You gave a Gandalf, I think it was a Gandalf quote, that talked about how we should do whatever is in us. Yeah. That's a pretty like Catholic formulation, right?
Oh yeah, because Tolkien was very Catholic. I mean, in my lecture on Tolkien's life, he was raised Catholic. Actually, his parents both died when he was very young, and his guardian was a Catholic priest. And he was devout Catholic for most of his life. He kind of fell away a little bit during the college years, like most of us do, but came back to it very strictly. He was a very, very devout Catholic. So you can read a lot of that in there. Yeah. I think there's a new movie out about Tolkien's life, just called Tolkien. And one of the things that I've heard that's missing, and I asked one of my students, I haven't seen it yet because I was gone when it came out. And my student said it doesn't talk about his Catholicism at all. And to do that is like to talk about... it's hard to imagine. It's the core idea that's central to his life is this Catholicism. It's a good observation.
I was wondering, when you talk about C.S. Lewis' Buddha section and his attitude with nature, I mostly think about the second book in his science fiction trilogy.
Yes.
I wonder if you're going to make some references.
I'm going to come and talk a little bit about Out of the Silent Planet, but also Perelandra as well. Yeah, in his science fiction, Alan Jacobs, who wrote a wonderful biography of Lewis called The Narnian, makes this observation that Lewis's books are remarkably consistent in their basic ideas, although they're not always consistent. For example, with the beavers at the table feeding the kids food, it's been winter in Narnia for 100 years. Where did they get the food? Well, okay, that was an inconsistency. But in any case, Jacobs makes the argument that his basic principles about nature and joy and those sorts of ideas are remarkably consistent in all of his novels. Yeah. And I am going to talk about that in just a little bit. Other questions? Well, ready to kind of move on? A few things. So what does that suggest with their view towards agriculture? Well, first of all, Lewis and Tolkien were very interested in local agriculture, people who cared about the land, who worked on the land for a long time, people who could kind of see fairies in the land or dryads in the trees or whatever. And some people criticize them as romantically unrealistic. But I would like to argue that he has kind of a romantically realistic view of trees and an agrarian lifestyle. And he does this both in his real life but also in his fantasy. And the same thing, I think, is true with Lewis with regard to animals. And again, I just want to remind you that these are the two main sources I'm still borrowing a lot from, especially Dickerson's work, because he points out, especially this part, I'm borrowing almost entirely from them and their ideas. And one of the things that they want to point out is they suggest that in these books, that there are ecological domains. We have lots of ecological domains in our society. For example, we live in cities. That's an ecological domain. And we have farms outside our cities, another ecological domain. And then we have cultivated forests, national parks, and then we have wilderness lands. And one of the things that Dickerson and Evans want to argue is that farmers have this sort of agrarian ethic, and conservationists have a sustainability ethic, and that there are others called preservationists have wilderness ethics. And their argument, this is an area that's way beyond me because I'm a medievalist, but their argument is that these three groups often don't agree, right? And they think Dickerson and Evans want to make the argument that if you move back to the writings of Lewis, for example, here's a picture from the movie The Hobbit, in which you have an agrarian ethic. You see the town of Hobbiton. And by the way, the word hobbit supposedly came from whole bit, and the idea is, if you break that down, it means earth dweller, or people live in holes on the ground. And so they live in the earth. They're very, very close to the earth. They actually live in the earth, and they make holes there. And one of the things is that they have a strong agrarian ethic that that farmers have. They should have a love for the land. The problem is that and this also comes through, again, with in the Narnia Chronicles, and I literally put in Beaver in them again to point out. You can see Aslan kind of up there as they're talking about him coming in through this. That they have, this is kind of the ideal. But one of the things that they realize is that there's a problem, there's a tension. And one of the things that is sometimes used is this idea of ecotones. Ecotones is a place of overlap, right? A city overlaps with farmers. Or you have a lake, right? And it's next to a farmland, but somebody has a house on the lake. And the farmer wants to use the water to irrigate the land, and vacationers want to use it with boats, and all of a sudden you have a conflict between the two different groups. Ecotones are the places where these biological or these ecological domains overlap. And one of the things we might learn from is, how do we manage this overlap? A great example of this here might be here at Holden, is kind of in, we have lots of conservationist concerns here at Holden, right? And this is a picture of Lothlorien when the hobbits and the Lord of the Rings come and notice that this is a tree dwelling of the elves. And the elves take care of the trees, they take care of the forest, they nurture them and want them, and they have a beauty there, right? But there's also a danger, and one of the things we have here is, like, we see deer walking into the village, right? That's an overlap. We want to be here, and when that bear comes around with her cub, that's an overlap, right? We get a little worried about it. And so the question is how much do we allow the overlap? Do we allow the bear to keep coming into the Holden, which might endanger children or people that are here? And so there are always tensions. So the question for Lewis and Tolkien was always, how do we manage these various different overlapping domains or ecotones? So the first one is, you know, this farmland versus the cultivated lands around it. I have a quote that I'd like to share. Let's see. So we have this sort of pastoral vision that we're seeking, and Wendell Berry has a really great essay called Margins, and he says, one time I went to visit the Peruvian Andes to see the farming practices of those that were living there. They had a very positive, sustainable agriculture that utilized and indeed depended upon the fact that it was on the margins. And yet, there were wild animals that came and ate their tame animals. And they are side by side. But they leave spaces for the wild, and they do not chop down the valuable forests that are around them simply because they're there or in their way, but they strive for a unity on the edges which honors both different ecological domain. Between the city, the farm, the farmland, and the wilderness, they seek the good of the land. And that's something I think that we sometimes forget, or we can be thankful to Lewis and Tolkien because they help us understand that there are these sorts of biological domains or ways of living. One of the things in The Lord of the Rings, you have the Shire, which is kind of a farming community, a city, a farming community, very simple, ordinary life. Then when Frodo, in order to save the Shire, must leave it. And so he has to go to the elves, goes to Rivendell and to the elves of Lothlorien, into the wilderness, into the forest. And then from there, series of events, some of the hobbits wind up in Fangorn, which is the wild forest, right? And it's very dangerous and very mysterious. And you have Ents, tree people, and especially a guy by the name of Treebeard, who is supposedly the oldest character in the world, Gandalf tells us. But when Merry and Pippin ask him, are you the oldest? He says, no, Tom Bombadil's older than I. So there's some question about that. But in any case, the oldest one of the oldest characters in the world, he's a tree, and they're out in the wild. And then all of a sudden, the evil Lord Saruman starts cutting down the trees of Fangorn. And then we know he's a villain, right? We see that this is a part of the problem. And so the question is, how do we live between these various barriers and boundaries that are established? And one of the things that Tolkien said, this is another one of Tolkien's drawings, this comes from The Hobbit, where the hobbits are floating down the river on barrels. One of the things that Tolkien and Lewis want to suggest, that there's also a wilderness in our imagination, that we lack our imagination to see solutions to the problems that are around us. We need more creative ability to work. Because one of the problems is that When once we start losing the wonder for creation and nature, we start seeing it as a commodity. And when we see it as a commodity, we don't worry about chopping down boreal forests in Canada for toilet paper, because we need toilet paper, and you can make a lot of money off these forests, and they're just sitting there. But the long-range term problem of these things is huge. For example, you go to Williston, North Dakota, where the oil fields are, and there was an oil boom in the 1980s. And you can go to any of the oil field pads that were in the 1980s, and nothing will grow on them. It is just dirt. And it will be dirt for hundreds of years. And they now have been putting up more and more oil pads and taking up more and more arable farmland for oil. Well, what do? You have a conflict, right? We want what? We want protection, or can we think more creatively about that? North Dakota is so windy, wind power would be a really natural solution. But again, it's not easy. We're still working with coal in North Dakota. And we have senators that promote that. Conservationists, but this idea is we need to see the beauty of nature. Notice how well he draws trees and cares about them. And we also need to see kind of, this is a dryad in one of the Lord of the Rings, is from Prince Caspian movie, where you can kind of see the wonder within the beauty of the trees. So how do we get back to that? Well, one of the things that Tolkien suggests is that we need to become shepherds of trees. Gandalf calls himself a shepherd of trees. And he takes care of them. And he says at one point, we need to get rid of our lust for lumber. Mary asks, one of the hobbits, talking about the wild forest of Fangorn, says, the forest is queer. Everything in it is very much more alive and more aware of what's going on than anything I ever saw on the Shire. And the trees do not like strangers. They watch you. I have thought all the trees were whispering to each other as we were walking through the forest, plotting some unintelligible plan to deal with us. The branches sway to and fro, and they sometimes grope at you in the wind. And yet, I cannot help but feel wonder here. One of the things that Tolkien builds into his story about ants is that the ant wives have begun lost. And Tolkien suggests that there is a grave crisis in our world, especially in Middle Earth, that these forests may be lost if we don't help them find the ant wives. And the end of the book is unclear, right? They never do. Last time you see Treebeard, the last thing he says to the hobbits is, if you ever hear of an ant wife, let me know. But you have this fear that there won't be any antlings at the end of the story. So it's haunting. He's giving us a warning about the future. One of the things about the wilderness of the imagination, and this gets back to what you were suggesting, is Lewis, I'm going to go off for a second on his science fiction trilogy. Lewis and Tolkien had a bet with each other that they should write two different types, they should write the books that they want to rewrite. And Tolkien said to Lewis, you should write science fiction, and he wrote three books, the first of which is Out of the Silent Planet, in which he creates a number of creatures off on Mars. Malacandra is the name of the planet. The Silent Planet is Earth. And one of the things that Lewis asked Tolkien to do was write a time travel novel, but he never got to it. Lewis was a big fan and liked H.G. Wells, but he couldn't ever figure out why there was this H.G. Wells, the War of the Worlds, right? That the Martians come and they're going to destroy the Earth, and the Martians are always evil, aliens are always evil, and you have this sort of trope. Lewis is one of the very first authors in science fiction to suggest that humans are the problem and not the aliens. And he goes there and he finds what he calls Hanau. These are sensible beings. They're different types of creatures. There's a Fiffle Friggy, just kind of like a frog and does art and good with science and machinery. There is the Harasa. They're kind of like farming animals and live out in the world. And then up in the mountains, there were Sorns, which are kind of like philosophers and astronomers. And they're all very, very different. The Sorns are kind of like birds. These are like otters. And Fiffle Friggies are like pigs. But the thing that he suggests is that they live in harmony with one another. This is what Lewis says in one of his letters. To be frank, I have no pleasure in looking forward to a meeting between humanity and an alien rational species. I observe how the white man has hitherto treated the black, and how even among civilized people, the stronger have been treated the weaker, or how the stronger have treated the weaker. If we encounter in the depths of space a race, however innocent and amiable, which is technologically weaker than ourselves, I do not doubt the same revolting story would be repeated over and over again. We shall enslave and deceive and exploit and exterminate. At the very least, we shall corrupt it with our vices and infect it with our diseases. We have filled our own with massacre, torture, syphilis, famine, dust bowls, and all is hideous to the eye and ear. Must we go on to affect new realms? The same problem, by the way, is beginning to threaten us as regard to dolphins. We have no more right to enslave them than to enslave our fellow humans, and some of us will continue to say this, and we can only expect mockery. Wow. Tolkien in his Silmarillion says, all have their worth, and each contributes to the worth of the other. The animal can flee or defend itself, whereas the plants, they cannot run away. They can only grow. And among these, I hold trees more dear than the others. Long in growing, swift shall they be in the felling, and unless they pay the toll with fruit upon the bough, little mourned will be their passing. And so I see in my thought, would that the trees might speak on behalf of all things that have roots and punish those that do not. There is a destruction element in the stories of Lord of the Rings and how evil works. This is Isengard, where Saruman is Lord. And notice he's created this great big factory, and it's just desolate land all around. They're cutting down the trees for producing power so that they can be industrialized. And Tolkien said of this, I am much in love with plants above all trees and have always been, and I find human maltreatment of them as hard to bear as ill-treatment of animals. I call it torture, the cutting down of trees. This is a scene of the Industrial Revolution in London. You can see the London Bridge there, or the Tower Bridge, I should say, in London. This was what they were living with. It's interesting, Tolkien, while he's creating villains, notice a very subtle difference. This is Saruman, the evil lord, and notice his staff. It's made of metal, and it has like a light bulb at the top. Now, Gandalf the Grey, up in the top right corner, has a staff, but it's a roots, it's a tree. And Radagast, another wizard who loves animals, he has a roots and a little gem in the top. And when Gandalf is reborn as Gandalf the White, he still has a wood staff. A subtle suggestion that metal is a problem in our society or technology. Tolkien and Lewis imagine the desolation of the environment. This is some fan art of the battle in the end of the Lion, which one wardrobe, and notice the animals being slaughtered that are here. Back in Oxford in 1960, at Harvard in 1960, Harvard decided that it would bulldoze a whole grove of trees so it could build the new student center. As it chopped down all the trees and there was just a barren lump of trees and they were starting to build, a student made a giant sign that says, just another bit of Mordor. Mordor is where the evil Lord Sauron lives. And that part, notice the farther away you get, the less nature can fulfill its function. In where Saruman lives, which is just outside where the elves lives, and Fangorn, they're starting to chop the trees down and the land is becoming desolate. But you get to Mordor farther away There is, even the land has turned against itself. The volcano is spewing things, and there's nothing that you can eat, and the water is completely polluted, and there's nothing you can do there. The land, and Sam, when he sees the land, says something like, "This land will never breathe again." But nature will have its revenge. In both The Lord of the Rings and in the Narnia Chronicles, in the Two Towers, the trees are finally roused to speak out and to fight against Saruman. And so they come, and they come to destroy. You can see the Ents coming to attack, and there was something Saruman hadn't counted on. And in the end, there's this suggestion that nature will win no matter what. We might destroy this earth, but whatever life will be here will somehow take over. Have you seen those things about how long it would take for a city to go back to its natural state? That's a lot quicker than we tend to think about. And in both of these novels, we have in the Prince Caspian, the end of Prince Caspian, this is one where Tolkien said to Lewis, "You just stole that from me," but is where the trees come in the end, right? And the trees save the day, which is what happened in the Two Towers. And Lewis tried to say, "No, I don't think that." "Yeah, you did." Okay, so they let that go. One of the things that Tolkien and Lewis therefore suggest that what we need to do is not, we need to find ways of preserving creation, which is our home. They start using the term, interchangeably using the idea of creation as the term home. And if we thought of all the world as our home, we would act with differently. And I think this is really important. And one of the things that Tolkien wasn't much of a walker, but Lewis would get him to go on walks. And Lewis loved to go on walking tours, and he would walk from town to town and take his time. And one of the things that I'm really struck by is I think as they are working with their ideas, they develop certain virtues are really, really important in their writings that come up. So, for example, I think the virtue of humility is one of the most important virtues that Lewis and Tolkien suggest that we need. Humility before creation, before nature and the world around us. And I think we have a lot of that when you come to Holden. I think that's one of the things that draws me back all the time. It humbles me to walk in this beautiful place. It teaches me a new respect, and it helps me to try to see the world as a different place. And what is that place? This gives me a sense of community. Another thing I think Holden does. I have this sort of feeling like I'm already with people I love and know, and I don't know all of your names, or we maybe haven't had a chance to have even a conversation, but I know somehow we're a community. We're here for the same sorts of reasons. We love the world. And that there's a certain contentment that we can have about the things that we have. So why not be like hobbits and give away things on our birthdays rather than receive them? And ultimately have a delight in the nature that we have. And I know that it's something that we love at Holden. And we have a certain contentment about the world. And whenever I come here, I always think about the things I have back there and what I don't need. and I delight in the beauty here. And also what Tolkien and Lewis suggest is we need firm, disciplined action. So what they mean by that is we need to take active measures to preserve creation, fighting for farm, forest, and the wild. And we need to bridge those ecotones and those edges. We need an imagination. Our imagination is healing. And when the Ents are roused, or the Shire, at the end, when Merry and Pippin and the hobbits come back, Sam and Frodo come back to the Shire, they find out that there's a guy there, Sharky. And it turns out that it's Saruman, who's, even though Isengard has been destroyed, he's working his evil within the Shire. And what they say is, we must rouse the Shire. The Shire is being destroyed. It's being turned into a place where industry and other things are being honored. So we have to rouse the people. And the question is, how do we do that? And I think Lewis and them are suggesting that one of the ways we rouse it is we need our artistic community. We need people like in the 60s singing protest songs, and we need artists making art, and we need people working in the fields that they have so that the people that come after us can have clean soil to till. Whatever we can do in whatever small way, we may think it's small, but remember Gandalf thinks that's the only hope that we have. Tolkien and Lewis suggest that we need to protect, preserve, and then celebrate. Somehow being Gandalf in the world, we are all wizards seeking the healing of creation. I just love this quote by Tolkien. It's a long one, so bear with me for a minute. It's on three slides. My church was not intended by our Lord to be static or to remain in the perpetual childhood, but to be a living organism, like a plant, which develops and changes in externals by the interactions of its bequeathed divine life and history, the particular circumstances of the world into which it is set. There is no resemblance between a mustard seed and a full-grown tree. That claimed Jesus, of course. For those things, in the days of its branching, grow the tree is the thing. For the history of a living thing is a part of its life, and a history of a divine thing is sacred. The wise know it began as a seed, but it is vain to try to dig it up, for it no longer exists. The seed, you know, right? People who suggest, oh, you know, we should go back to the good old days of the church. And Tolkien said, no, we have to adapt. We have to be the church in the modern world. We need to grow. We need to be a plant. We need to be strong. We need to be a tree. The wise know it began as a seed, but it's vain to dig it up, for it no longer exists. And the virtues and powers that it had now reside in the tree. The keeper of the tree must look after it according to such wisdom as they suggest. Prune it, remove cankers, get rid of the parasites, and so forth. The church has its own problems, but they will certainly do harm if they are obsessed with going back to the seed or even to the first days of the plant when it was, they imagine, pretty and uninfected by evils. Lewis put it this way, we may ignore, but nowhere evade the presence of God. You can ignore, but you can never evade the presence of God. The world is crowded with God and walks everywhere where he, and God walks everywhere incognito. This is a wall cloud that I took a picture of that I had the awesome fear of witnessing. Lightning was coming out of my wife and I were standing on the edge of the lake. We saw this thing moving and I wasn't sure whether it was a tornado. It was absolutely horrifying. There's something about the word holy in Hebrew means other. Holy other. And the other is everything else beside us. And God, as the other, is in those others. And God is incognito in those things. And we need to find that and show others how that comes out. What can we do then? There is evil in Mordor, to be sure. And there is a white witch in Narnia, to be sure. But Tolkien suggests that we should use our imagination to rouse the Ents and the Shire. Or as Lewis puts it, you're never too old to set another goal or to dream a new dream. And I would like to repeat my favorite theologian's comment again. Some believe it is only great power that can hold evil in check, but it is not what I have found. I have found that it is the small everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keep the darkness at bay, small acts of kindness and love. Lewis says this in his Four Loves. We need not surrender the love of nature to the debunkers. There are debunkers who do not love nature. We need not surrender the love of nature to the debunkers. Nature cannot satisfy the desire she arouses. Nature creates a desire in us for beauty and for God. She cannot satisfy that, nor answer the theological questions, nor sanctify us. But the love of her has been a valuable and, for most people, an indispensable invitation to God and to love. So, imagination, whether it's in The Lord of the Rings or The Chronicles of Narnia, or whether it's just in a village that we're all familiar with, a place that haunts our imaginations and encourages us to be the best that we can be so that we can till the fields of love that are still around us. We need to open the door. Once Tolkien was accused of writing literature was escapist. And Tolkien had this response to the people. Getting caught up. Okay, here we are. Tolkien says, if you live in a prison, to live a life that just lives within those four walls is truly madness. If we live in a prison, if you just live within those four walls, you live in truly madness. You must escape with your mind. It is the only sane way to be in this world. The prisoner should not love the prison, but it should look out the window to the beauty of creation where the prisoner can escape to God. The imagination, a fantasy, can look out the window of our prisons and help us change the world. I'd like to suggest then that Tolkien and Lewis are ecologists of creation, but also ecologists of the body, the heart, and the mind and the soul, and our imaginations, and we need to go together with that. Tolkien one time, and I'd like to end on this quote, it was on the 20th anniversary of The Hobbit. Tolkien was asked to go to Venice to give a speech. And he got there, and he spent all his time floating around in gondolas. He just thought the gondolas were really cool. He couldn't imagine a town that had transportation that wasn't mechanized. And so he writes this. At a toast at the Hobbit dinner, which he was the guest, he said, well, it's been exactly 20 years since I began in earnest to complete the history of our revered Hobbit ancestors in the Third Age. So I look east, west, north, and south, and I do not see Sauron anywhere, but I still see Saruman. He has many descendants, but we are Hobbits. We Hobbits have against them no necessary magic weapons, but we are gentle Hobbits. We are resilient. We have a great deal of courage. And so I give you this toast, my friends, to you, my Hobbits. May we outlast the Sarumans of our world and see in the springs the trees leaf once again. And that's my toast to you as well. Thank you.